Welcome back to the American Master Chef's Order, AMCO Podcast. I'm Certified Master Chef Gerald Ford, and I'm here today with Master Chef Jason Hall to discuss a Certified Master Chef exam pre-plan. This is part four of a six-part series. Today's podcast, we're going to dive into equipment, how much to bring, how much not to bring, working with your apprentice, personal nutrition, and the development of yourself in order to verify skills at the exam. This podcast is recorded in association with South Bend Equipment, Winco Equipment, Colorado Mills Sunflower Seed Oil, and is published under the American Master Chef's Order. And I'm really excited, and I know Chef Hall is very excited to share this with you. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome to the show. Personal utensils, right? I mean, you definitely want to make sure you have what you need, but there is, I think there is a, such a thing as too much, right?
You know, I don't think you need to bring every pot and pan, but you know, you're only cooking for 6 to 8 people. So it is a good idea to bring some small sauce vessels. While every test site has plenty of larger and medium size and maybe even some small sauce pots, I would think more about my finishing station. You know, what do I want to be plating up in? I don't want a 4-quart sauce pot with my final sauce in it that I'm now holding over top of, you know, my service table and spooning out of. I would engineer or gear my thinking at this point more towards what do I want to use every day for plate up? Where am I going to bring these sauces down in? Obviously, probably what the host facility has, but what am I going to transfer it into? How am I going to hold my sauces for service? And what do I want to serve out of during service? The answer to me were little, you know, 8-ounce and 6-ounce, 10-ounce sauce pots. So I had, you know, 5 or 6 of those, and that's all I needed because every day I'm going to rinse and repeat that program. Those are still going with me. They're, you know, they might be pre-labeled. You know, Joe and I had a system where we would label the handles of what was going to be for what prior to leaving the hotel. He would, you know, say this is going to be duck sauce and this is going to be for beurre blanc, etc. So it just was more targeted for me because I could grab it and knew that's exactly what it was for. But again, it doesn't have to be 50 of those things. You know, you're not cooking for the masses here, but I really gear my thinking and my packing of those personal utensils more towards the final stages of cooking than the beginnings, outside of the things that we just spoke of. So it doesn't need to be a lot, but that plate up station, that service station needs to be thought through as well. You know, having a clean linen to drape across the table to prevent that, in some cases, you know, cold stainless steel transferring to your plates. Having an extra sheet tray that you can throw in the oven to get hot that you maybe put underneath that white linen to create a heat source to keep your plates warm as you go up in your window. Having a different bane of just utensils that you plate with, because the last thing you want to do is get ready to start plating and you're using the same utensils that are in your bane that's beside your cooking stove that you've been using all day long. Have a small, intimate little bane of utensils that are just used for final plating. You know, offset spatulas, male and female spoons, tweezers if you really have to have them. But usually a smaller set of tongs is even better because you're able to move much more quickly. And that's your plating station, you know, plate wipes and your plating component list, which I always kept a separate one that was just with my service table setup. That way there's nothing being spilled on it. It was already laminated from the night before. Again, that was a Joe task. You know, so I could just easily, when we're transitioning into service, have my Comey pre-coached on exactly what I wanted. There's the box for service. You're going to pull the sheet tray out of the oven. You're going to drape the white linen over it. And you're going to set up the plate wipes and everything else on the right-hand side because I'm left-handed and I work opposite everybody else. So, you know, those simple instructions and thoughts are going to save you minutes, which become very, very valuable. If not longer. So, keeping those things separate and thinking things through and keeping a separate bane also in that plating kit of just tasting spoons for plating as opposed to the ones that are over on the stove for cooking. It helped me to just know that I had them. You know, you might be blowing through tasting spoons one day and you only have four left for service. Well, you don't want that to happen. So make it a mandatory part of your station packing list that it has those as well.
Well, and the same applies for deli and mise containers, right?
Absolutely. I'll tell you, in the 2010 exam, there weren't enough deli containers and mise en place containers. So I was going to the store. You know, I went to the store probably three times throughout the week to get more small mise en place deli containers, which that goes back to that would have been something I could have had my assistant go do if we fast forwarded 2 years or if I had, you know, planned to have someone with me that first time out. But those things I would definitely bring. I brought a few sleeves of every size. Again, you know, you're not cooking for a ton of people. So a couple sleeves of those very easily can get you through the entire week, you know, and you don't need many quarts because of the volume of food that you're producing. So I tended to have, you know, the smaller sizes. But again, that was something that I had Joe pack for me in my box to go out every morning. We already knew how many mise en place containers we would need and what sizes. So that all went into our pack box as well. And they were neatly stacked so that I could, again, straight lines create order. I had I was fortunate to have a shelf in front of me most days. So I just had my deli containers lined up out there. And that's what my Comey and myself both grabbed from in order to prep and move forward throughout the program.
Well, and your story really stood out to me when you talked about, I remember I could feel the pain when you were talking about your 2010 experience. And because of that, I know that I brought my gloves, my deli containers, my 2 ounce, 4 ounce with lids, without lids, my tasting spoons. And at my test, my understanding was that was also, I mean, I don't want to say that they ran short, but there was definitely a point when there were people scrambling to try and find deli containers. And, you know, I didn't deal with any of it because I knew what I had, I knew what I needed, and I had what I needed, period, you know?
Yep, exactly. I mean, we had a really large class in 2010. I think there was 13 of us initially. And so, I mean, that stuff went quick. You know, the host facility had as much as they thought they needed. Some people consumed way more than they probably needed to. Some probably got thrown away and didn't get rinsed and dried and used for the next day, which was probably the host facility's plan. And so it didn't work out we were all at the store. It wasn't just one of us, you know, but it was a struggle. Then you have, you know, 8 or 10 of us all shopping for what the stores don't have a ton of either. And, you know, so I never wanted to feel that stress or pressure or frustration again. So, you know, as we practiced and as we prepared to go back for the 12 test, I said, you know, I'm not going to have any of these things affect me this time. This is my test, and I'm not going to overdo it. But I'm going to have exactly what I know I need because I experienced some of those shortcomings, which were, you know, which inevitably, you know, had a negative effect on the whole thing. But, another good thing about that whole process is back to this, you know, turning your hotel into a storeroom. You know, we had one area that was just, you know, a couple of sizes of deli container. So it was very easy to keep all of that stuff organized to pull for the next day. So we were just packing what we needed. You know, and really at the end, we didn't have much left over. I think I gave out some deli containers to those who ran short, you know, during the 12 exam. But it definitely makes a big difference. Plate wipes, same thing. Those were all done. We had plate wipes packed in deli containers labeled days 1 through 8 before we ever even left the club. Those were in the boxes. So as much of that stuff that can be done needs to be done prior to travel so that you're not ever scrambling to get any of that stuff. And you can really put your mind and focus your mind on what your goal is, and that you're there to have a successful exam and you're there to focus on the food every single moment of the day. 'Cause life kind of fades away there. You really, get this tunnel vision of just the exam and just the focus and just the food. And you have to, it's a very, very large program to get through.
Same goes for plate wipes, right? And, you know, you actually, I love that you have bottled water or Powerade, right? So taking care of yourself.
Exactly. I had bottled water or Powerade in my pack list every day that went into my cooler. I made sure to bring one for my Comey as well. That went into the kitchen with me. I threw them in the cooler. Again, 2010, I did not drink enough water. I did not consume enough nutrients, and that was, you know, on me. But again, coming into the 2012, I needed and knew that I had to be really physically and mentally there, and hydration is massive. The 2012 exam was in the middle of August, early August. Again, we had no AC for the first 3 days. So it was a necessity. And everybody was very supportive of you hydrating, but it doesn't matter what the weather's like outside. You need to stay hydrated. So no one's going to tell you can't have bottled water in your low boy or something like that. I just made it part of my pack list every single day to make sure I had a couple of those in there for sure.
So that moves us into the apprentice section, right? You talked about taking care of your apprentice and making sure that you had water or Powerade for your apprentice. What a huge asset to the test. And your section is beautifully written, so I'm going to let you go on with
Thanks.
That.
Yeah, the apprentice is your lifeline. They are going to save you. You know, that you have to rely on that person for every single need you have while you're in that kitchen. And you also have to nurture them through as well. I remember one of the practices that we did with Steven Ginta, and it was, again, myself, Ryan Baxter, Sean Loving, I believe Amanda Zimlich was at that one as well. And Steven sat down and said, you know, what are you doing tomorrow, Jason? And I said, I'm doing classical. And I remember him saying, you don't have 4 hours, you have 8 hours. And I thought, wow, I can blow this thing out of the water then, you know? And he said, because your apprentice also has 4 hours. And that was one of those moments that really changed my mindset of how to work this other person, how to have that person mostly benefit my time in the kitchen. I had never really thought of it that way. I just always thought of it as four and a half hours. But that eye-opening moment, you know, you think to yourself, I could do this entire thing in 8 hours. I could probably finish the whole thing in six and a half by myself. But if you're able to manage, the lesson there is, if you're able to manage and maximize your Comey's 4 hour time along with yours, providing you exactly what you need when you need it, you're going to be successful with your plan that's on paper. And it takes a little bit of figuring out that balance. Again, back to 2010, I had days where I never had what I needed from my apprentice. That's my fault. That was me not getting the point across, or me not getting the prep list worked out so that his or her prep list and when they finished a task benefited my next need. That was the number one thing that I kind of struggled with the first time around. And so, you know, and that comes to how to maximize this person's time. Where do you need them to be? When do you need them to be there? And when does it benefit you most for them to finish this task or that task? And so that's kind of how I started to rethink my whole prep list, you know, as far as how I worked this person and how I inspired this person. And that was a great thing. And I'll never, ever forget that quote. And I always really preach that to someone who's starting off for the first time. So a couple of things, when you're doing practices, you know, at your shop, I always practiced with one of my first year culinary students to get my program where I needed it to be. Number one, it inspires that new strong person who's coming in and is excited to be a part of your culinary program at your place. But also it lets you see if what you have written on paper, someone who's never seen it before can get done, and also you to get what you need from them when you need it. It's better that they are a little bit unsure or not comfortable with your style, because that's what's really truly going to test your prep list. And you're not going to know these people prior to taking the exam. You're not going to have much interaction with them prior to walking in a kitchen and relying on each other together for the next 4 or 5, 6 hours of a day and even longer during buffet catering. So your plan has to be so comfortable that anybody who is new to it can see it, understand it, and execute at a high level to benefit you through your day. So that's why I always say, use that first year culinary student. Use someone who is new to your shop, who maybe hasn't done much else other than prep or a little bit of line work, hasn't spent a ton of time with you. Number one, it's going to get that person excited that you're involving them in this massive undertaking that you've decided to approach. It's going to, have a ton of goodwill and benefits going forward, because this person is excited to be a part of your facility and you're working now side by side with them. The benefit to you is that it's going to show you exactly where you have any holes in your program, because as you cook through that, you're going to realize quickly whether you have what you need or you don't. I really tried to think, how can I get this person farther ahead of me? That's my ultimate goal. They don't need to be working on the same thing as me at the same time. I need them 2 or 3 projects out from me. So how do you gain that time advantage? And the answer was quite simple. It's the difference is fabrication. In the beginning of your day, in the beginning of your run, that person, the apprentice, the commis, might be off grabbing some things in the first few minutes, sanitizer and cutting boards and things like that. But your goal as the candidate is, number one, fabrication, getting sauces, bones, the developments of flavors happening on the stove. That time period is completely up to you. Usually it's somewhere in the 30 to 45 minute range. Sometimes it's a little bit longer than that. Let's hope it's not too much longer, but 30 to 45 minutes, you can give this person the advantage to jump ahead of you. And that's what you need. So if you look at it from a different standpoint, when you get out of butchery, fabrication, and the beginnings of your sauce making, and you're at that 45 minute mark, what's the first thing that you want to do? What's the first next task? Is it risotto because you're doing a fritter? Is it roasting mushrooms because you need to, infuse that into a piece that you're crafting? Well, then guess what? That's that person's first food task. So that you can keep them 45 minutes ahead of you, hypothetically. That's the way I reworked my plan, so that as soon as they're done hunting and gathering the little things that they might need, you're stuck in butchery, fabrication, and the labor of that love for, the foreseeable short-term future. Let their first task be the first thing you need 45, 50 minutes from now. That's done. It's on a tray. It's labeled. It's in the cooler. They move on to the second thing, which guess what? That's your second thing after you come out of fabrication. If you can work your program to that mindset, you're 99% of the time going to have what you need when you need it. If you can keep them ahead of you, keep them inspired, keep them thinking and talking and communicating with you, because you've memorized basically everything that you're going to have to do this day because you're so immersed in your program, you're going to be able to be fabricating and be handling all those first processes and asking them, is everything prepped for tomato jam? Is everything prepped for the mushroom duck cell? Is everything prepped for the mousseline that I need to turn around and do as soon as I come out of fab? If those things are done, then your next task is going to only let them jump one task further. So it's kind of that leapfrog version. So I have kind of listed in here my version. Go ahead. That's kind of my version of the tray system, is that as they finish their task, it goes on to a consolidated mise en place tray that goes into the cooler. So when you're ready for something, you're grabbing almost a final kit. Now, if you have shallots on 10 different things, well, then have them do all the shallots in the beginning. You know, if and herbs don't need to be there until later in the program. So, you know, I never pushed my apprentice or Comey to do any herbs until we had that kind of break before service where I'm doing the more constructing and building and shaping and possibly, you know, breading of things, etc. That's the time that you'll find later on to push them into those. Those aren't a necessary upfront thing. You're not finishing with parsley in the first hour. So don't have any of that done until later. Instead, refocus them on the bulk prep that you need to get started on the other side. You know, and like I said, if there's mirepoix in the first three things, have them cut all the mirepoix for all three, put it aside and start to ploss it out on the trays as they prep it. But all that can be kind of explained in a little later version as well.
And when you do that with a Comey, it buys you a little bit of time to get some evaluation on them. I mean, the majority of time you're going to have a different Comey most days. You rarely, unless you draw a station or unless there's, you know, some by chance, you end up with the same, you know, Comey or apprentice two days during an exam. It buys you a little bit of time to make an evaluation. And so you have time to adjust their list to see what they're able to handle. You can do your butchery and keep an eye on your Comey and say, okay, wow, this person's ripping through their mies, or okay, I'm gonna have to speed up because I'm gonna need to, you know, to work a little bit more to get what I need, you know, to keep myself in the right place. And if you start off with them working on tasks in front of you, you don't have that pressure of just crushing them right off the bat.
Yeah, absolutely. I tried to always work side by side as much as possible, depending on how some of the stations were laid out, you know, so that I could see those things, you know, and to a point I made earlier, you don't have a lot of time to get to know this person. You know, my experience was we got the email list and a phone number of who we were going to have the next day, sometime before we left the school the day prior. So I would send an intro email. Hey, my name's Jason Hall. I'm going to be with you tomorrow, and I'm really excited. Here's the menu. I never overwhelm them with, here's a prep list, here's all the recipes. They don't need to be studying that stuff. They're not even going to know where to start. Send them the simple menu and a simple welcome and a simple, hey, I'm excited to get in the kitchen and do classical with you tomorrow. So they can look at the menu and they can be like, wow, this is cool. And keep some of that information. You want them to get a good night's sleep. You don't want them to be, you know, Google searching everything that you have given them for the next 4 hours of their night. Keep them comfortable, keep them excited, keep them engaged. And so that was my process. I would send a simple email, intro, the menu, and say, hey, I'm really excited for tomorrow. Please be at the school at, you know, we're going off at 8. So please be at the school at, you know, 6:45. I would just want to have a short 20-minute meeting with you and kind of go through my expectations of the day. Always, always, always make sure that you're able to set up that time frame prior to starting with them so that you can say, this is my program. This is how I work. This is how your prep list looks. This is how my prep list looks. Here's my goal, is to keep you 45 minutes ahead of me. Anytime there's downtime, I expect you to sweep the floor, wipe the stations down, keep us looking super fresh and clean. If you have any questions during this, you know, I want you to ask me, but also we need to keep communicating on every single thing. Call out what you're doing next. Call out while you're putting something away. I'm going to ask to see some of the work that you do. It's not to second guess it. It's so that I know where it is when I need to approach it. You know, and really just making them feel comfortable. I'm excited about today. We're going to make this really great, you know, tart that I've been working on, or, you know, this fabrication is going to, let us make these really great terrines. And I can't wait for you to taste them later. You've got to inspire excitement within them because they're more nervous than you are. I guarantee it. And so the more comfortable they are, the more clear and concise and sensible it is for them to read through your program and approach it, you're going to have massive buy-in. You're going to have someone who's going to, you know, work until the end of the day for you at full speed. And that's really what you want, is to have that person who will say, yes, chef, and they're in. They've, and you got to build that buy-in with some simple communications on the front side without overwhelming them. And then have that 20-minute meeting in the morning and say, this is how our program works. You're going to follow these bullet points. This is all you're going to have to do. You're going to look at the bullet point, refer it to this short little prep. It's going to go onto a tray. It's going to go in the cooler. I'm going to ask you for that at some point. You're going to know where it is and give it to me. If there's something else that needs to be done, and I'm going to show you these things as we go, and I want you tasting food as we go, we're going to have a really successful day. And so working with them is key, and not against them in any way, shape, or form. And overstressing them, giving them too much information on the front side before they really need it is not good. They're already in school and they have other things going on. They're there to help us and help you get through this exam. So, you know, really encouraging their performance is huge. Like I said earlier, I still have a couple that I keep in touch with and hear from every now and then through social media. We had really great days in the kitchen together. And, you know, handshakes, you know, great job. Those little rewards at the end and before we start to get them excited about what's about to happen. You've got to inspire the confidence in them as you approach this thing, because you're going to have a completely different level of worker. And as you said, you know, you're going to it absolutely is. How you work with this person is completely evaluated by the floor proctors. And like you said, you may not have the same person. It's very likely you will not have the same person more than one or two times throughout the experience. Some of their school schedules only allow them to apprentice once or twice. You know, and so this plan has to be clear to everyone who sees it. And that's why I revert back to what I said earlier. Practicing with that first year culinary student is going to test your plan to see if it is understandable at that level, that they're able to still get you what you want when you need it. If it works there, it's going to work at the actual exam. And making sure they taste the food, you know, that's part of this too, is that they're there to learn. They're there to see what cooking at this high level is all about, because it probably is an aspiration of theirs. They may be interested in it. We want to push those next generations of master chefs. So letting them taste, experience the food. At the end, there's a slice left over. You know, let them have that. Let them experience exactly what the expectation of this test is, from how you execute to how you cook and to what things taste like.
And that's, you know, that's a snapshot of what a master chef, or what an ideal master chef would be a mentor, would be, you know, not necessarily a teacher in the school sense, but, you know, all chefs have the need to teach and to train and to work with a staff. And I would definitely say that that's, you know, that is a huge component of it. One of the really cool things that I've noticed with working with Rich and doing the class with Rich and being on calls with Rich is that he and I are very similar, but we're also very different in our approach, you know, and one of the things that I keep noticing, or one of the things I noticed specifically from the class we did in January, was offering those two perspectives and saying, look, Rich was successful, and this is how Rich was successful, and this is how I'm successful, and this is what I did. So, you know, here are some of the things that I adopted from Rich, and here are some of the things that I adopted from Jason Hall. And, you know, and Rich could talk about his time with Peter or with John. And we could, you know, we could framework the whole thing out. And then both of us kind of had the same exact message of like, look, this is your test. And we just want to open your eyes to an approach and to how seriously you need to manage this process. It's not just a day of cooking. It's not just making a recipe. It's a process, and it's more about who you become through the process. And it's about your development.
Yeah, you become a master through the process of developing this in a lot of ways. You know what I mean? Like, the test is just verification. The mastery comes during the building of yourself up to the goal. that's where the proving ground is. You know, I think that I remember someone saying something similar to that once, that some people, you know, are some people are, come to the exam and they're, you know, they're a master before they, you know, they get there, because they've developed all this on their own. And, you know, that because you have seen the scope and you know the expectation, you know what has to be done, all of that is done before you even arrive. You know, everything is part of a well-executed, thought-out program from every little aspect of it. And the food is part of that too, but there's so much else aside from the food that makes you successful and makes you comfortable being successful. And that's done all on the front side. So the kind of the test is passed before you're there, in a way. If you're able to accomplish all of these things, you're just showing up, you know?
Well, you know, I don't know if many people know this about me, but I spend a lot of time, you know, with visualization. And, you know, I believe mantras are a big thing. And look, I'm the psychopath who was hanging stuff in the preparation room for the test. And my hotel room had, you know, all sorts of random motivational stuff on the wall. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, I kept reminding myself was, I'm a master chef. I'm cooking like a master chef, you know, and that helped me work through some of that negative self-talk, because it's a real thing. At least I recognize it's a real thing. And the mind can be a tremendous ally and an asset, or a tremendous obstacle, depending on how you approach it, you know. And I whenever I felt negative self-talk, you know, it was, I belong here. I'm here because I belong here. And, you know, it may sound hokey. I don't really care. It worked, you know, like it, that was something that got me through some tough moments, you know, like I referenced to, having the master chefs, you know, gather around your station. And, you know, ideally in the test, you get to a point where you don't even recognize when they're gathering around. You're so focused on your program. But in the earlier days on the test, you know, you're very aware of everything that's going on around you. And, you know, if you're constantly thinking about, God, what did I just do wrong? Oh, what did I just do wrong? You're heading down a very dangerous path. It's a very slippery slope, right? Because then you just get into quicksand and you're just perpetuating mistakes. And, you know, like I remember my window opened, right? And windows are staggered so that everybody in the kitchen can watch you plate. it's not because you're doing anything wrong. Like, you know, it's plate up time. Everybody's going to be there, right? Like, don't worry. Like, everybody knows to be on your station at 7 o'clock. They're going to be there. And so, you know, sometimes having that, you know, that just that little bump of like, you know, I remember telling myself to shut up. They belong here. They're supposed to be here. You're supposed to do it. Now focus on your food. God damn it. You know, like just having that self-talk and reminding yourself like, look, this is a verification of your skills. Go into that test knowing that you've mastered it. And I think in order to do that, you need to have some pre-evaluation. You need to have some real honest conversation and some hard conversations to understand if you're at the level that you need to be in order to be successful, you know. And we talked about, you know, a master chef is a master cook, but it is a master chef's exam. So all the things that you manage as a chef become things that you have to manage in the test as well. Yeah.
It really is. I mean, I completely follow the same types of things. I had things hung up all over, you know, my hotel room. I had, you know, a couple of really nice quotes from Russell and a couple of the others as I led up to my 12 exam. And I had that posted right in front of my desk. You know, things that family and friends had sent me, as best wishes. I had that. So as soon as I looked up from my computer, as soon as I looked up from what I was working on, I had that re-encouragement of why I was there, you know, if there was ever any doubt, you know, when you don't pass the first time, it's easy to get wrapped up in and think, well, what if I slip on what I was good at last time. That was one thing that was very hard for me between exams, was I kept thinking, I know what I have to work on, but God forbid I make a mistake on something that I was strong at. Well, how will I recover from that? You know, that was a really tricky mental thing for me to get over, because it becomes so much of what you put on yourself. And let's face it, I mean, very rarely are we ever completely satisfied with anything we do. We're just constantly manufacturing and rebuilding and taking it to the next level, ripping it all back down, starting the whole thing again. You know, I mean, I've tweaked my entire life over and over and over again to fit those things within food. I don't think there's ever been one chef's table where I was like, well, that was perfect. I only think about, this course was good, but I'm never doing that part again, and this didn't feel right, you know. That's who we are as chefs. And so that's something that works massively beneficial towards what we do, because we just don't ever stop. But also that can also work negatively, especially when everything is on the line here, you know, and you start to think about, well, you know, my buffet catering was great. What if I make a mistake on it next time? And the lesson is just to practice that almost as much as the other things. For me, I still practice the things that I did well, just to rebuild my confidence in them. And, you know, between exams, after 10 was over and I decided, you know, I'm definitely going to do this again, I went to, Staples and I bought it was like a 4x5 foot dry erase board. And I hung it, I took the pictures down, and I hung it in my living room, and I wrote, healthy, buffet catering, classical, all the way out. And I wrote my pros and cons of 2010. So I was forced to look at them every single day when I came home. It made me really absorb and just fully saturate myself into what my goal was. That might not be helpful for everybody, because there were negative things on there, but it really reminded me of what to do. And I used that as a working board throughout my prep time. You know, I would come home and make a note next to something that I was uncomfortable on for healthy, you know, not strong enough flavor building development the first time out. Well, now this is what I've done, so this is where I feel comfortable. And I kept those things in my face as I led up to it. You know, I thought that was best for me. But yeah, I'm definitely more of the visionary positive influence kind of thing as well. And I think that the more you surround yourself with that, the more comfort you have when you get back to the hotel, let's say every night, and you're grinding through the next process. It's just going to give a better energy to you and to your program to surround yourself with as much of that as possible without constant communication, because that's something that I personally, like I said, cut out of my daily activities at the exam. I couldn't be distracted. I needed to be 100% involved. So
would you call it a mantra? I mean, of the master chefs or of AMCO is forever the student, right? So always trying to learn, always trying to do better. And look, the more you know, the more you realize you can learn. And I definitely see that with all the interactions that I've had of, you know, all the chefs who've passed the test before me. And I can say that's a common trait. And that's definitely a curiosity that I think helps perpetuate the mindset. I think this is probably the best place for us to stop, and we'll pick up again in the next episode.
Hi, my name is Jason Hall. I'm the president of AMCO, or the American Master Chef's Order. Some history on AMCO. It was formed in 2014 by a group of master chefs, including Bill Franklin, who spearheaded this concept. The idea was to look at the brand, see how we can further develop it and develop the exam going forward to meet ever-changing needs within the industry, to offer a coming together of our guild once you've passed the exam on the other side, and then also to start to develop the training and support needed for candidates as they approach the exam. Our mission is to promote, sustain, and perfect our craft, all while identifying and supporting and inspiring the next generation of candidates as they progress towards becoming an American Master Chef. You can reach us and see more information on our website at AmericanMasterChefsOrder.org. Thank you.
Please subscribe or share if any of this information has impacted you in a positive way. I'd like to thank you very much for your participation in joining us in. For any resources discussed during the course of the podcast, please check the AMCO website, AmericanMasterChefOrder.com, to find it there.
On behalf of AMCO, I would like to thank everyone for listening today